Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we're speaking with James Dines, author of the longstanding investment newsletter, The Dines Letter, and author of a number of books on investing, precious metals, and interestingly, mass psychology. He describes himself as the original gold bug, the original rare earths bug, and the original uranium bug, and he has a truly impressive track record on timing entry and exit points in these markets for his subscribers. Now today, we're going to talk about the next big trends he sees on the horizon, and as well, we're going to explore the role human nature plays in influencing future events in unexpected ways. Of course, that's what we care about is the future here. Mr. Dines, welcome. It's a real pleasure having you as a guest today.
Oh, thank you.
So you have this incredible track record of predicting the big shifts and trends well in advance of the crowd, whether that was the internet in 1997 or rare earths years before they hit the front page. What are the big trends and shifts that are really catching your attention today?
The world right now is at a crossroads in a number of different ways, and it's going to be very important to make wise moves because of the cross currents going on. There's a conflict between whether political systems should be based on more force or more government control, and those who feel that there should be less government. And that's expressed in the political system going on in America right now, in the political debate between the various factions. There's also a religious war going on around the world. And there's also a terrible currency problem internationally based on the fact that all paper currencies, not backed by anything tangible except the word of the government, that is, the result of which is that it is able for governments are able to borrow and spend as basically as much as they want and run up frightening debt. The debt levels are approaching truly dangerous levels, especially, of course, in Europe, but with Greece in the headlines approaching bankruptcy, it's important to understand that the United States itself is on a road of debt accumulation that puts it on the same trajectory as Greece. So, therefore, I've led my subscribers toward a number of areas that I think should do best, although there's no longer any totally safe place to hide, not even bonds, which are so overpriced that the yields are insultingly low and vulnerable to a serious market crash on their own, but also even cash is vulnerable to an eruption of hyperinflation. So one must invest keeping dangers in mind. The crashes in real estate and banks are a lesson that this is no longer a comfortable world where one can just buy some blue chips and go back to snoozing. And as a result, we have focused on companies with wealth in the ground, hard assets that cannot be printed away. You can print all the money you want, but if you've got a gold mine with gold in it, or gold coins, or gold and silver stocks, especially purchased on weakness, then you've got a chance of surviving what is probably coming.
Well, you know what I'm very interested to get your perspective on then is, you know, so I've heard people say there's a lot of comparisons to the 70s. You know, the inflation that we had then. Of course, we had wage and price spirals, and there were a number of notable differences, the U.S. being a net creditor nation and a net export positive nation, et cetera. But with the differences noted, how do you see where we are today as being fundamentally different from the 70s, if it is or it isn't. I've noted in some of your writings, you've talked about how there's nowhere to hide anymore. So I think in the 70s, you could choose an alternative currency, you could choose an alternative stock market, you could find another corner of the world potentially to go and hide in for a while. Everything seems to be fully correlated, all the stock markets rising and falling as one, as well, all the currencies linked. And so in this world of interconnectedness and the high degree of correlation between nearly all of the assets, with gold being a fairly notable exception there, what are you seeing in terms of what's different this time and why we might not be able to use the 70s as a backdrop for what's going to happen this time?
That's a good question. The similarities are numerous, actually, and the 1978-79 was a time of inflation in America, and the government was truly panicked as to watching it get out of control. One of the main differences was, at that time, the bond market, the United States government bond market, was in deep trouble. You were getting 12% on a U.S. government bond. At that point, the Dimes Letter recommended loading up on them because that was a once-in-a-lifetime event. But otherwise, it was very similar, and the decision was made in Washington to run the printing presses even faster. So rather than take the decline and accept it and wring out the excess debt out of the system, they decided to kick it up to stratospheric levels. This is something that's been done a number of times before. When the U.S. currency was really sound, something very important, people don't really know their history, and as Santayana said, those who don't know their history are doomed to relive it. In 1918, Germany was stuck with paying for World War One, and they ran out of money in about 2 years. They ran out of gold money 2 years later and began to run the printing press, and they had a ferocious hyperinflation from 1920 to 1923, and then finally it was obvious they were not going to be able to pay for World War One, and the Allies made a frightening decision in 1922 at the Genoa Conference, which you'll have a lot of trouble finding in your history books, but if you dig it out, you can. And I go through this in detail in my Gold Bug book, but they decided to double the money supply, and that led to the boom of the 1920s, and that was the inflation. And then the inevitable deflation occurred in the 1930s. And all kinds of remedies were tried, and especially running the printing presses and getting into more debt. It worked a little bit, but then Roosevelt raised taxes again in 37, and things caved in again. They were printing too much money. It was the wrong remedy. Then World War II came along, and then they began printing money again, and then we had another long inflation. And that hit a peak in 1980. It culminated in the 1970s. And we've basically been in a long deflation ever since. And we're in a deflation right now. This is the coming great deflation I wrote about at the time. And you can see it in the prices of labor is down, real estate, consumer electronics, all kinds of things are down. And right now, they're trying to inflate just one more time, and my Goldblatt book explains how this is going to risks going into a hyperinflation here in America, and it's not a very pretty picture because hyperinflations always result in very bad things. So that means that even cash in your safety deposit box might not be safe. It's a very difficult environment to invest in, and we're focusing on wealth in the ground assets.
So this hyperinflation, if and when it comes, is this going to be a result of money that is already printed and out of the box? How do we square the circle where we've got a lot of deflation happening? Obviously, when we look at total credit market debt. We're seeing that, yes, the private sectors and government sectors are holding up reasonably well in the non-financial arena. But in the financial arena, of course, the shadow banking system, huge difficulties and a lot of declines there in credit overall. This deflation that we're seeing some of it expressed in prices. But if we look at it in terms of money and credit, money supplies are up, M2, very robust graphs coming out of the Federal Reserve on that statistic. But credit itself is down. So where does this hyperinflation come from in your mind? Is this because there's a huge resumption of credit in the future, or is this already from money that's outstanding in the system today?
The QE1 was quantitative easing, which is double talk from America's Federal Reserve, concealing the fact from those innocents who didn't know the difference between what it really meant. In fact, they were increasing the quantity of money by trillions of dollars in QE1 and QE2, and they're talking about another trillion in QE3 now. So fanaticism is continuing doing the same thing you're doing, expecting a different result. And the more money they print, the higher the risk of a hyperinflation. So you're getting the, you said there's a robust amount of money out. Yeah, it's robust, but there's too much money chasing the same goods. My gold bug points out that gold needs to represent actual wealth being created. When you print more paper than actual wealth, you have more money chasing the same goods and services. So an inflation is inevitable. Right now, it's falling on a deflation, so they're getting away with very low inflation numbers. And the economists can't explain it. They don't understand why all this paper money is not creating an inflation. And all it's doing is deepening the deflationary forces that can be interrupted by a hyperinflation. Hyperinflation is what I call the supernova of inflations. And while a lot of prices are down, you'll notice some other prices are up. For example, here in San Francisco, the price of the Golden Gate Bridge, is just in the last 10 years, has gone up from $1 to $6, which means your dollar's purchasing power is one-sixth of what it was just 10 years ago. But that's a monopoly. It's a bridge and there's no competition. So competition is holding prices down in some areas, whereas it's beginning to show up as an inflation in others. We are now at a crossroads of a potential transition to a very dangerous time, and investing must be done with great care.
Well, this inflation, it's very spotty right now, and one of the criteria we need for that is to have the wage spiral as part of that, which is clearly broken for, I guess, global reasons, but unemployment is very high. It's hard for me to imagine that real wages are going to climb anytime soon here. At the same time, we see that for basic services that can't be imported, I don't know, college tuition for one, running at a far higher rate of inflation than inflation itself as measured by the CPI.
Yeah, that's evidence also.
Evidence, yes, and healthcare. So of the things which, you know, we really can't import any of, and there's really no global market for, you know, Harvard has to be here, and so does my healthcare. Those things are running at extraordinary rates of inflation, very high single digits, maybe sometimes even low double digits, depending on what we're looking at. So in this world you're seeing of deflation and inflation, it's not really either or, it's kind of a yes at this point, isn't it?
Yes.
And so in this future of hyperinflation, is it also a yes where you see some things are could still be in deflation even as other things are becoming unaffordably expensive? Is that a possibility?
That's right. That's why it's so confusing to people who don't really understand what's happening beneath the surface. They're now talking about QE3. Remember, this is an election year in America. And until November passes, we won't know what the government is going to do. Right now, they're trying to do as little as possible, so they can't be blamed for anything. But the hypodermic needle is in. You know, even notice the use of the words inject new stimulus into the money supply. I mean, money is addictive, and printing more of it has worked so well in the past that they think it's going to continue working. But I recommend that portfolios take very special precautions, and we specialize in getting in very early to what I call super major bull markets, where the prices are so low and the gains are so assured that it's it really would matter less if what goes on around it. Our latest bull market was in rare earths, and when I became the original rare earth bug 3 years ago, very few people even knew what they were, but these are 17 elements in the periodic table of elements that have very special attributes that will be extremely important in the future in anything from electric automobiles such as the Prius, or in cruise missiles, military uses. There, your cell phone is small precisely because it can employ rare earths. China has a virtual monopoly of 97% of the world's production. So I was basically betting on a cartel, and I knew that the prices would go up. And, of course, they went up by thousands of percent. The actual rare earth elements went up in price, such as neodymium, praseodymium, dysprosium. But also, we dug out the leading stocks in it, and right now we're still buying and holding them. So that's one way. You need to make money faster than the inflation is going to happen, which is quite a challenge. But just buying ordinary old investment ideas is not going to work in the coming period.
Well, I would particularly apply that. I can't, for the life of me, I don't know who's buying 30-year bonds at 3% from the U.S. government.
Forget the
inflation risk, but where's the credit risk in there? There's got to be, you know, when you dismantle the balance sheet of the United States government, which you can do with a crayon and a napkin and a couple of drinks. It's not hard. There's clearly a huge imbalance there, which is going to have to be resolved either through printing or through a vast cutting of benefits or through some raising of taxes, which is just a transference of wealth. So one way or the other, we're going to have to pay that piper, and I don't see how that squares up with a 3% rate on a 30-year, personally.
Well, I don't think it's 3%. I think it's less than that. And second of all, it's taxable. Don't leave that out, although not to foreigners, perhaps. But if you subtract even the current low inflation rates from it, of whatever it is, 2% BL, that is before lies, you're basically losing money, owning it. That's why it's the same as holding cash. It's not the salvation. Now, corporate bonds pay more, but then again, you're running corporate risk. When you say you don't know how it's going to be paid off, it cannot be paid off. And that is the understanding you must come out of. If you get anything out of my work, you have to get that that's not going to happen. They're borrowing money with no intention of paying it off. Politicians hope to be safely dead by the time it hits the fan. You know, this year alone, America is going to be running a deficit of $1.3 trillion.
Yep.
And most people don't really even grasp how much $1 trillion is. But $1 trillion, if you spent $1 million a day, if you spent $1 million each and every day from now on, back to the time of Jesus' birth, you could not spend $1 trillion. And right now, America's debt is approaching $15 trillion, which are numbers useful in astronomy. And
yeah.
And how is America going to earn that with Facebook and Twitter corporations? Our industrial base is gone, and entitlements of fixed forced payments are a large and growing section of it. We're in a number of wars. People don't even realize it's not just Iraq and Afghanistan. We now have troops in Central Africa. We've just opened up a base in northern Australia for a stare-down confrontation with China.
Mm-hmm.
And on and on. America's got unmanned drone aircraft in the Somalian-Eritrean theater. Did you know that? I mean, America is at war in a number of places and reducing its military to save money. I mean, the whole thing is terrifying, and they don't seem to understand that the politicians are the inmates in the asylum running it.
Yeah, it does feel kind of late-stage empire-ish from time to time, and I note that the United States, I think this current fiscal year is on track to spend roughly 100% more than it takes in revenue. Clearly not a sustainable condition, and every country that's ever gotten close to that mark before, I think 40% is a mark that Rogoff had come up with in noting that historically countries that have gotten over that 40% expenditure mark had suffered currency corrections, pretty significant ones. But the U.S. is just not any old country, of course. It issues the main reserve currency of the world. Well, what are your thoughts here? When I look at this deficit situation, I know it's getting some play in this political cycle, but not nearly as serious an amount of, let's say, adult-sized conversation as I would have been hoping for at this particular juncture.
Well, the one example is our gold signal. The latest one was flashed 11 years ago. We're not day-to-day traders. I've never met a rich day-to-day trader. It might work for a little while, then there's one big loss, wipes it all out. We got into gold 11 years ago and around $300 an ounce, and recently it got up almost to $2,000 an ounce. And we got into silver at $4.50 an ounce at that time, and that recently got up almost to $50 an ounce. We flashed a sell signal on it. So these huge gains are impressive, but they're not really gains. Out of our 65 dinesisms, the number 7 is the toga, the dines theory of gold relativity. And it's hard to imagine this, but the price of gold and silver did not go up. It's the paper money that went down. Gold and silver are the ultimate money, coins of which are good anywhere in the world, no matter what's stamped on it. And that is the money. And depending on the amount of paper each nation prints, is the price of gold in that particular country or in that particular currency. So that is one way we were protected, by the price of gold. Gold is the only asset in the world that, investable asset in the world, that has gone up the last 11 years without interruption. And that's because they're just running the printing presses, and the more they do, the more value builds into gold and silver. Now, of course, it will have its fluctuations. It went down in the 08 crash, but came right back up and made new highs. So we tend to ride those out, and it's very important understanding what the main trend is. And when you're really clear on what's happening in the world, you know how to place your bets instead of doing it blindly or just following casual recommendations from people.
Well, you know, one of the biggest trends that I've been tracking and that I formulate much of my own investment thesis around, and which I've been working very hard to alert people to and work with my subscribers on, is around the idea of peak oil. And we have plenty of admissions and data now, with tons of data, that says we're past cheap oil, right? So the easy stuff's all been found, of course. That's what we do as humans. We high-grade our best resources first. We go after the easiest and most capital returning prospects that we possibly can, whether we're mining gold or we're farming soils or we're pumping oil out of the ground. Same dynamic. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the idea of the structural shift that's contained in the idea that we're out of the cheap and easy energy, because energy is not any resource. It's the master resource from which all other resources are required and built upon. What are your thoughts around where we are in the energy story right now?
Energy is, of course, extremely important. And we've been writing in recent years about the coming resource imperialism. And by that, I began writing about, I founded the Neo-Malthusian School of Economics, which says that the planet is limited and the population is soaring. And it's, by brute logic, it's obviously unsustainable. You can't just keep having more and more people on the same planet without someday, sooner or later, running out. And the nations that perceive this would start buying assets with that in mind. The primary example, of course, is China. They're wide awake to what I've just said, and they're buying vast tracts of farmland in Africa, Australia and the American Middle West, everywhere, as much as they can get, because holding land is better than holding paper that's depreciating. They've also buying copper mines, and I've already mentioned rare earths. They were quietly buying up that industry while America was snoozing, and I was screaming bloody murder about it, but for example, they almost got away with Union Oil, and it's a barely concealed asset that is now America's only rare earth mine that will be functioning in a year and a two. So there will come a time when, and in not too distant future, where the last new copper mine on the planet will be found. Hard to believe because there's always been more. But with the world's population soaring into the billions on an accelerating uptrend, something's going to break along with the currency going to break. Things are going to be happening here from out of nowhere. And because when you're going at high speeds toward a brick wall in the dark, things can happen very quickly. And it began to crumble, I think, in the crash of 08. The banking system began to feel it. So in terms of energy, there's no question that peak oil is somewhere around here. Hubble's famous prediction. America's peak oil, at the time he made it, America was the great oil producer in the 1950s. It was only a half century ago. He said that America would reach peak oil, and it certainly has been true here. The large oil discoveries, occasionally one comes in offshore Brazil. There's probably going to be one or two somewhere. But basically, you're setting that up against the fact that in Africa, for example, they're going to eventually want the American dream. They're going to want cars and all the uses of oil and production of plastics and all the other wonderful things that come out of crude petroleum. And so the rapidly increasing demand and the shrinking supply of oil, despite any short-term oversupply, which is probably true now, is going to lead to a stratospherically higher oil prices. As soon as the military grasps that they will start needing to put windmills on airplanes, they will seize the remaining supplies. You will not be able to drive your car until the last drop. So at some point, there are some very disruptive changes coming to society. That said, it's very important what's happening in the fracking field, the fracturing rock and the new technology wringing the last few drops of oil and natural gas out of rocks. And this has suddenly unleashed a whole new supply, and which is changing the dynamics of it, and might well postpone not peak oil, but peak energy, because there is so much natural gas coming out of America now that the price in the commodities futures markets is down to $2.50 and threatens to go even lower, and you're starting to get production being turned off because they can't function at these low prices. And I'm not sure how that's going to play out. I mean, there, of course, I personally think that we should leave it locked up there for two or three centuries from now when the world is going to be shivering in the dark. But America is, and the rest of the world, is simply using up the assets in this generation at a rate far greater than anything done before. And there are plenty of nations that do not have natural gas reserves, blessed the way we do. America is now the Saudi Arabia of natural gas, and we'll probably liquefy it and sell it as LNG all over the world until we're out again, just as we began to run out of oil, using every last asset. You must remember, these are not renewable assets. These are our inheritance, and they can be squandered, and that's what the world has been doing. And in a lecture tour of Australia, I told them to be very careful about all the mines they're selling to China, because those mines will be sending product to China for the next few centuries until they're used up. China's not buying them to resell at a higher price. And this is what I meant by commodity imperialism.
Well, it's just fascinating. You know, we're at this unusual period of history, and it's happening so fast, I think it's difficult for a lot of people to grasp. So here's an interesting statistic. If somebody is 22 years old today, they've been alive when half of all the oil ever burned throughout history has been burned. You know, we've been using it for, you know, since 1859, but really it's when you're compounding your use of something at 1, 2, 3% a year, really, you know, it's the last few decades that really count in that story. And so here we are at a very interesting sweep of history where, you know, either we're at peak oil right now or in 10 years. In some case respects, I don't care if it's now or in 10 years, because that's a blink of a historical eye. It's happening now by all intents and purposes. And so when I was talking with Jim Puplav on an interview recently, he had a very good point. I love this phrase. He said, oil is the new Fed funds rate, meaning that in the past, when you had ample resources and everything was a function of money, we just put more money into the economy, it comes back to life and people go out and get more oil or other resources. It was your Fed's fund rate that sort of dictated your total level of economic activity. But if energy is your master resource, and now the price of oil is somewhat immune to whatever you're doing over there on the monetary side, except it tends to respond when you print too much of it, the oil at $100 a barrel is not really consistent with any economic recovery that I can find in the historical series. That's part one. Part two, we see that our total debt loads are going to require extraordinary economic growth if we have any hope, and I'm going to use the word hope very carefully here, if we're going to have any hope of having those debt piles resolve themselves through the normal mechanisms of a resumption of economic growth and a tame level of inflation, and we sort of continue to build them even as we're digging out from under them. I'm looking at energy now as something that I don't believe anybody in the halls of power, I don't think there's anybody on the Federal Reserve Board that understands the energy story in the way they need to in order to begin to combine what's happening in energy from a structural geological standpoint with how we operate our monetary system and the policies we implement and the decisions we make. I think there's still a huge gap there. Fortunately, that means there's a huge gap there that people who are clever and can see this coming can exploit that gap and do reasonably well. But on balance, I think this story ends relatively poorly, and it ends poorly for the money system. Energy is a function of reality. It's physics. It's nature. It's reality. I think it's the money system that falls apart in this story. And that's sort of the angle I've been going towards, looking at peak oil not as a matter of theory, not as a religion I adhere to, not as anything I particularly believe in, but a set of facts and observations that lead me to conclude there's a higher possibility and probability of seeing a crack up in our money system. And this time it's global, a higher possibility of a crack up in the global money system, by which I mean the fiat money system born in 1971, than at any other period of history I can really look at. This feels unique to me in that way. Do you have any resonance with that sort of set of confluence of ideas, or does that make sense to you? I know you've been at this a lot longer than I have, and one thing I worry about is that I'm just a new guy looking at new information and thinking it's all new, when in fact it's just an old story and it'll repeat again and again.
You're on the right road in that the price of oil is comparable with the price of gold. It's a one-time asset that the Saudis are wisely taking the money they sell it for, which they sell it, and buying hard assets, including gold, but also land and real estate. And again, this is economic imperialism. Oil is reality, and you can print all you want, but the amount of oil remains the same. I think energy is very important, and the question is how you play it. Now, if you are an owner of oil, whether it's in the fracking oil here in America or elsewhere, that you're just selling a capital asset, you're selling an inheritance, and that's one thing. But the question is how most of us who do not own oil fields, how do we play that? And that goes one step further than your perception and than your sound perception. And the question is, how do you play that? Well, you can either buy oil stocks, and And that's a good idea, I think, as in the vagaries of those that have crude reserves. That's why I think Exxon has been so strong, although they themselves are now moving into natural gas in a big way. They themselves realize that the large fields are either been discovered already, or that the political situation in them with sticky-fingered politicians makes that untenable. I'm playing it in a different way. I was the original uranium bug when the uranium was $8 a pound, and it went up to $138 a pound. Perhaps I should have sold it there, but I was taking a longer view, and it's come back now about halfway. It's about $60 a pound now, and I think it's also going to go much higher, because beyond oil, you have uranium, and for money that you want to put away for the long term, I think that's one of the areas. And the 08 crash, and again, the crash last year, and by the way, we did have a crash last year in 2011. It was concealed by the Dow Jones Industrial Average up, but just about every other average in the world was down, and some by 20% or more. And the low-price stocks had huge drops, all of them. I mean, nothing survived. And but that makes them even more underpriced. And we're getting, just in the last few weeks here, just in January alone, some of the uranium stocks that we like are, like Fission Energy is up 27% just this month. Uranium Energy is up 37%. Paladin up 40%. Uraner's up 43%, and Laramide is up 56%. So you're getting a tremendous rally. This is how you make serious money. I mean, if you can make 56% in 1 month, you can outrun inflation, and even in a deflation, who cares? That's even better. So it's a question of how you play. Yeah, your perception is of peak oil is correct, but there's also the factor of natural gas fracking, and also how you play it. And I'm playing the oil boom by investing in the fracking area, and also in the uranium mining area, uranium stock mining area. And they're still selling for pennies here. I think there's way more higher prices ahead.
Interesting. I'm a big fan of what we can do with natural gas. Of course, there's an extraordinary infrastructure build-out that'll be required for us to begin to use it in any meaningful percentage way for transportation, for instance. We know how to build natural gas electricity plants, and we're doing that hand over fist. But to really take use and make use of those assets in replacement features for oil, we're going to have to do a lot of work. And I think there's stories there. There's, you know, picks and shovels companies are going to be in that infrastructure play. There's certainly some important things there. You know, I have to ask this question. You have the Dines Greed Fear Oscillator Index, and you've written that it's useful for unmasking emotions rippling through a crowd and taking control of each individual's behavior during certain market moves. For example, inducing shareholders to sell when they should be buying and vice versa. So here's my question. When it comes to the broad stock markets, I was interviewing Joe Thaluzzi of Themis Trading recently, and he talks about the advent of high-frequency trading and other program trading, all of this stuff being driven purely by the algorithmic logic that's coded into these computers. Have the emotions that have long driven the stock market's behavior been at least partially coded right out of the market? That is, can we really use traditional technical analysis and other tried-and-true forms that were carefully developed around the observations of the fact that it was humans that were doing the trading? Has anything really fundamentally changed there for you?
That's a smart question. Let's see. The way I would approach that is is the French phrase, il faut reculer pour mieux sauter, which means take a step back to jump forward better. I was when I first got to Wall Street, it was all fundamental analysis. It was just accounting, studying management and how much the company could earn and what the dividend stream might be like, and that was the way stocks were valued. If the calculations were higher than the current price, it was a buy, and very mechanically, if it was lower, then it was to be avoided. I couldn't make money doing that very well, and so I was one of the original pioneers of technical analysis, My particular area was point and figure charting and technical indicators. And that really helped my timing a great deal, but it still wasn't working for me all the time, although it was a big improvement. And I began thinking out as to whether or not there might not be another force operating in the market. I came up with the idea of mass psychology having an impact, but there was no other analyst in the world talking about how to use mass psychology. And as I began to ponder on it over the years, I noticed that all market moves, really, all major market moves, were based on an oscillation between mass greed and mass fear. So I began to study these emotions and spent a great deal of time reading psychoanalytical books in the library and pondering on it, and I came up with my third book, Mass Psychology. And we use that very much. I'll give you an example in a moment. Very much in our work. And there's even one stage beyond that. If you're interested, I'll go into that. What I discovered was that that all of psychology now focuses on an individual vertically, and by that I mean a combination of his or her genes and experiences, and that's who we are. But I felt that there was another level of mind affecting all of us, and I couldn't find any way to identify it. But when I did watch crowds of investors, I could see emotions rippling through it, and how people abandon one of their positions almost thoughtlessly, depending on the group around them. And I could begin to dimly visualize that there was some force at work that was invisible but definitely there. And then I began to study the movement of animals, the herds, and how they move together. But that, of course, could be a signal of some kind, a sound or a visual. And I came across these huge masses of starlings, birds in Scotland. And when you watch them in the sky forming these fractal shapes, they are obviously being operated on by a single force. And I put a photograph of them in my mass psychology book, which was published in 1995 and printed in 96. And it's right in the front of the book. And at that point, that was my way of saying that is the only picture of a mass mind I've ever seen. And just last month, there was some excitement of some girls in Scotland canoeing who pulled out their trusty telephone and photographed these same starlings. And they were awed by the way they were moving, and this began to went on the internet and went viral. And I was thrilled that not only did it finally attract attention, but the scientific community said that they could not figure out how it was being done, how a bird could turn within a millisecond of a bird hundreds of feet away and with intervening birds, and how that could possibly have happened. And I smile to myself because there is no signal. They are being influenced by a force that is incomprehensible. Yes, the scientists are right. They said it was incomprehensible how this is being done. And it is. And I've wrestled with it a great deal, and obviously having written a book on it, have spent, there's a lot of facets to it. For example, you can watch gamblers, and I read a lot of books on gambling and came up with the realization that all gamblers secretly desire to lose. And that's shocking, but, you know, even when they win, they'll keep playing until they do lose. I mean, so there's a secret desire to lose, and that is a mass phenomenon. That can be expressed in the mass. And that is why when I saw all the gamblers clustering, for example, in 2006 and 2007, I predicted on international television. In fact, the Nightly Business Report, they said, what do you think of real estate? And I said, we're going to have a crash in real estate that will affect the banks. And they just brushed right past it. They didn't think it was possible. But I was watching the gambling going on, the flipping of houses. Mm-hmm. People were not buying a house. They were buying numbers of them to sell them immediately. That's the gambling element. So in the mass, if you really study it and pay attention to what's around you, the trouble is it affects you also. I mean, it takes a great deal of will and discipline to steel myself against being swept up by the mass. 9/11 was another one, when everybody in the world reacted, regardless of your individual genes and experiences, they reacted the same way. So if you pay attention to the mass, this is another major factor in my work. And it even works on a nearer term scale. Last October, the pessimism concerning Europe was so intense that I flashed a buy signal on October 7th, which was within 3 days of the low, and I said, we're in for a big year-end rally. And, of course, the market went vertical after that, and we've had a tremendous rally that's lasted here into January. And that was done not only with fundamentals and technical, but also mass psychology. And the situation last week was so opposite to that, that I was watching on television, all the talking heads were optimistic all of a sudden. Nobody rang a bell, nobody said anything, nobody noticed that they had just changed their positions 180 degrees, and they became so optimistic that I flashed a sell signal on effective October 25th. It was after the close on the 24th. And so far, that's been the top day. And that kind of timing you can't get with technical analysis. It's you can't get a hole in one in an uptrend. You can't sell an uptrend like that and nail it. And I think it doesn't matter whether you're doing minute-to-minute trading or not. All that will do will get you closer in touch with mass moves. And however it voids any of the other three disciplines, it will follow the lessons of mass psychology. And that is part of the work I would like to leave behind me in my books, and because I've worked a long time to get these things thought out. And there's even another level that I'm working on now. My fifth and final book is on what I call Secrets of High States. And that focuses not on the psychology of the mass, but on the psychology of us, of the baggage we bring to money, having been introduced to it very early in our lives, at a time when Sigmund Freud said our minds are like a ball of soft wax, where even a light touch would leave a fingerprint. We all have baggage on money, feelings about it, and that's a prism through which the mass psychology infiltrates and will impact on it, like the way Sir Isaac Newton's light going through a triangular piece of glass will splay the light out into its individual component colors. And unless you have a true understanding of your relationship to money and who you are as a person in high states, you will, even if you have the other three disciplines nailed down, this one will deceive you into getting you to talk yourself into going against what you know you should be doing and then misstepping. Does any of that make sense?
It does. It says that during the first part of our lives, we go out into the world and we collect information from out around us, and that at some point you have to understand that the next journey is inward, and that the true mastery of the world involves mastering yourself more than facts and figures and data and information from outside. Is that right?
That's correct. And I try to use all these disciplines in the letter, and I think that's why we've been able to call some of these turns. And every one of the three that I've discovered, technical analysis and mass psychology and high states, every one of them are simply, technical analysis, the mere possession of a chart will get you fired as an analyst on Wall Street at first. Now it's all over television. Mass psychology is still not being discussed, but is still regarded askance. And high states, nobody's even talking about yet. So nobody's going to pay you for for what you get out of the newspaper, or that's yesterday's news, and that's already been acted on in the market. You need to really anticipate. You need to drink upstream from the herd if you want to make money in the stock market and survive.
Absolutely. You know, all of this plays into my final question. This is, I've saved the most important one for last, I think. And it goes like this. You've made a long career out of bucking the trends and sticking your neck out long before the rest of the crowd, drinking upstream from the herd, which means that you're something of a professional at knowing what it's like to be disbelieved, human resistance to change and truly out-of-the-box thinking, and what it takes to convince people that something new is on the way. We deal with that every day over in my corner of the world as we see these enormous structural, almost certainly disruptive changes coming on the horizon. So some people say that puts us in the Cassandra box, but it just happens to be reality as we see it currently. That's what the data says. And of course, there are always new opportunities in any period of change, and our mission is to help people see those as early as possible. My question then is, what's your advice to those who've got friends, family, colleagues, loved ones, whom they wish to convince of the idea that the good old days are just not coming back, and that a prudent person should take some relatively simple precautions with their portfolio, with where they live, even with the things that they are focusing on or consider priorities in life? How do you negotiate a world where you see things that other people don't, and how do you communicate those?
Oh, that's a good one. I wrote my fifth book, Secrets of High States, to answer that very question. You can't convince people, and the very act of trying to activates Dinopa, the Dynes Nature of Paradox, which is, we don't have time to go into here now, but there's a whole chapter of that in my mass psychology book. Paradox is when you, like if somebody wears a sign, please don't kick me, everybody immediately kicks them. Or the person you wanted in your life you couldn't get, and the one you didn't want you couldn't get rid of. That's paradox. And when you try to convince people, you activate the same forces. You can't convince people, and it's a mistake to try. And if you try and it's not working, you'll notice that the harder you try, the less it works. Mm-hmm. You have to go about and move around the question to the other person and getting them clear on high states. And if you get them clear on that, they can get more receptive to being open to the new things coming at them. And what I do now is I don't advertise the Dynes letter. It doesn't matter to me if people read it or not, because I'm in the high state of service. I've served, and once I do, I get into the high state of detachment from result. Mm-hmm. I can't explain those terms now, but that's in my DVD. But when I do that, I might keep doing it. I mean, I still telegraph what I'm saying, and some people will hear it and some won't, and the people in high states are the ones who would hear it. So, you know, you might be well-intentioned trying to convince your friends and relatives, but the idea of trying to convince them is what's holding you back. And that's a very difficult thing to get around, because you've got to work on them first, getting them clear on being open to ideas. And if they're not, there's nothing you can do. They're just going to have to be whipped by the whipped as flotsam and jetsam on the waves of what's coming.
I followed completely what you're talking about. I discovered, I think, your principle by accident on my own a while ago, and I learned that the harder I tried, the less successful I was at convincing people. And then ultimately,
good for you.
Wherever they happen to be is right where they need to be. So if they're still in denial, that's exactly where they need to be. And if they're in depression around this stuff, or they're in the bargaining stage, or they're at acceptance, it is not my job to move them from any of those states to another state. It's to simply acknowledge that they're there, and that's where they need to be. And I can be somewhere else, and that's totally fine. And as soon as I adopted that lack of attachment to outcome, meaning I'm not trying to move them from point A to B, I discovered I became a lot more successful at moving them. So to move them, I had to not move them, consciously anyway.
Well, that's good. That's paradox. And you sound as if you've been following my work, but that's exactly right. And that's what I do. I mean, I've shared my knowledge in this interview, and I'm complete with it. And people can ignore it or not. It's the same to me. I mean, I've done what I need to do for my own high states, and I'm glad to serve and share what I know, and instead of, I could have kept it to myself and just not said anything, which did not attract all the hassles that it invites. But I decided to take a middle road, and I, you know, I've learned a lot of these things the hard way. I once tried to convince people, and it didn't work. They just got angry. And now I just, like today, I mean, I've just shared my views, and anybody who's listening, you can hear it or not, follow it or not. I want you to be clear that I'm detached from that result.
Fantastic. Well, Mr. Dines, this has been a fabulous interview, and I want to let you know I'm waiting for High States to come out. Do you have a idea when that book's going to come out?
We have it on a DVD right now, actually. It's on my website.
Fantastic. And how would people find your website if they wanted to?
Just dinesletter.com. My staff will take care of you. It's dinesletter.com.
Right, and I would advise people also, Mass Psychology is out, and check out your website and the newsletter. It's been in operation for quite a while and has a great track record. So thank you so much, Mr. Dines. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, same here, and I wish you good luck in your work. You sound as if you're on the right track.
Thank you very much.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.